Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we continue our conversation with Paul Hetherington about his work, plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. Last week on Poetry on the Radio, we spoke with Paul Hetherington about his 17 books of poetry and his experience writing them. When we left off, he was describing how he has grappled, in his many books, with fundamental challenges of communication, always seeking to invite readers to share in that quest. That's certainly a key theme of his latest book, Ragged Disclosures, which was published in 2022 by Recent Work Press. Its disclosures are ragged because human relations with each other, with other beings, and with elements of life are themselves ragged. Paul Hetherington says he searches for words that don't shirk the complications, yet at the same time provide readers with access to them. This week, we take off from that point. I first asked Paul Hetherington to read some poems from Ragged Disclosures.
I'd love to read something. I mean, it's a book that has got so many different elements in it, and it's trying to make connections between quite different kinds of experiences. The section at the end, which is sort of more lyrical, there's a poem called The Flight of Bats. I could read that.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, it's right in the middle, but one of my favorites is Gargoyles.
Okay, that little poem. Well, yeah. I love Gargoyles. Yeah. It's a little poem. I mean, some of these poems, in terms of my experience as a writer, come out of, you know, I love places like Rome and trips to, I'm fascinated by culture. I love painting and the visual arts more generally. So, you know, I've looked at many a gargoyle in my life, and yeah, they fascinate me. Gargoyles, without guile, diminutive statues that trade in words of water, we fail to remember our names. We're children whose souls hardened. If only we could stretch arms or marshal sentences. But we live in the stifled aftermath of prayer, dressed in lineaments of general fear, spewing awkward notions. Our gushing eloquence is broken. Inclement weather shuts us down, even as we shush the closing evening and pretty avenues.
This whole poem is such a gorgeous moment. It's because it's a moment that moves in the tiniest of ways, right? Starting with these diminutive statues that, if anyone has traveled, you see them and they're sort of part of the backdrop. And so immediately we're suddenly paying attention to something we might just really not normally look at. And then we're children whose souls hardened. Like that leap is immediate, right? And then we're in this different world with the gargoyle, but we're in the same world as well. And I think that's what poetry can do. It can put us in several places simultaneously. But I think that's what your poems do especially well. It's like a type of suspension, and it's not easy to pull off.
Let's listen again to Paul Hetherington reading the poem.
Gargoyles, without guile, diminutive statues that trade in words of water, we fail to remember our names. We're children whose souls hardened. If only we could stretch arms or marshal sentences. But we live in the stifled aftermath of prayer, dressed in lineaments of general fear, spewing awkward notions. Our gushing eloquence is broken. Inclement weather shuts us down, even as we shush the closing evening and pretty avenues. I'm fascinated by the way in which, as we are in the world, and as we witness it, as we see things, we are transported often in ways that they're not sort of postcard-like experiences. Mm. They're not just sort of saying, well, I saw this, or I saw that, or this looks like a pretty view or something. But actually we're transported quite laterally and sometimes quite shockingly. And if you then are interested, which I am, in history and art and culture. And, you know, history is not a very pretty side. Mm. It doesn't present a very pretty side if you look at it anywhere, really. And some of the stuff that we see that have kind of symbolic or meanings, and or they're kind of connected to sort of cultures or cultural understandings which we only partly understand, but which go quite deeply, some of them back into folklore, back into other cultures, back into long ideas. Mm. You know, I'm talking about millennia, go sure. through millennia, then, you know, a small thing like a gargoyle can suddenly seem to be very, very potent as an image of, well, the things we can't quite grasp, the things we can't quite express. And if I can find that moment in my writing, I'm fascinated by it, just because I'm interested in what it is that I might be thinking, trying to think through.
In some ways, then it comes through you, and yet you're surprised by it.
Yeah, I think poetry is, poetry is going to be good, it almost always has to have some element of surprise, even if it sneaks up on you. I mean, some poetry surprises you, kind of, bam, you know, it kind of hits you with surprise. Yeah. But other poetry, I think, the surprise might be more embedded and quieter. But, yeah, I think surprise in poetry is a key feature, but not necessarily a superficial form of surprise,
no.
You know, like a form of surprise that might get inside you and be winkling its way.
Oh, I love that, winkling. I think winkling should have been one of the 107 words.
Should have been. Now that you've said it, I think I'll publish a new edition called 108 Words.
Mad winkling. It's a great word. Will you read the other poem that you...
Sure. So this is towards the end of the walk, and this is where the relationship between the two characters, sort of aspects of their intimacy are being explored. The flight of bats. Thought swerves through images as a bat accelerates through air. You stand in memory, your dripping shirt brown from dirty river water, air and sunshine colliding, a smile lifting your mouth. I'd hold you as I did when you spoke of thought as knotted and tangled thread, when our love was umber, arms linking shadowed synapses with nerve and world. Our tensed bodies were skin listening antennae, and a swarming feeling dragged us into air. Night had the colour of dark words. I'm there, you said, sensation expanding like the sudden flight of bats, sending ultrasound, tonguing and hearing, sensing gardens and movement, finding in echolocation the fetching shapes of night and body.
It's just gorgeous. The poem itself has a flight, right, in the imagination. There's a whole world here that seems in your imagination quite clear. But what you've had to do is the poet, is make choices, right? What part of that world that is so clear to you are you going to bring to us? And it kind of comes like the flight of a bat and that echoing, right? It comes in parcels or in bits rather than a whole. But then we puzzle it together. We've got a theme here for sure.
Let's listen to Paul Hetherington reading that poem again too.
The flight of bats. Thought swerves through images as a bat accelerates through air. You stand in memory, your dripping shirt brown from dirty river water, air and sunshine colliding, a smile lifting your mouth. I'd hold you as I did when you spoke of thought as knotted and tangled thread, when our love was umber, arms linking shadowed synapses with nerve and world. Our tensed bodies were skin listening antennae, and a swarming feeling dragged us into air. Night had the colour of dark words. I'm there, you said, sensation expanding like the sudden flight of bats, sending ultrasound, tonguing and hearing, sensing gardens and movement, finding in echolocation the fetching shapes of night and body. I love images that connect not only to art, but to the creaturely life. I mean, gargoyles, even though they're stone, they connect to a set of sense of creaturely life, a sort of a fantastical one in a way.
Yeah.
And, with the sort of wildness of animal life, like bats, I'm fascinated by, and particularly that idea of echolocation in that poem, that sense that things are bouncing off one another.
Right.
And that's how bats sort of see or navigate or whatever. But human beings are doing a lot of that stuff, that bouncing off, that kind of, in a metaphorical sense, that sort of echolocation. And it's not a process which is easily understandable in the kind of polite words that we, you know, speak at coffee shops and so on.
Images do that too.
They do, yeah.
And words as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, poetry, I mean, throughout the history of poetry, right back to the earliest poems, you know, images are being employed all the time in poetry. And, you know, we have, obviously, in the 20th century, the imagist movement and a lot of interest in how images work in poems, which is fascinating. But I think, you know, images in poems, if they start to speak through and out of a poem, if they become embedded within and are kind of intrinsic, truly intrinsic to a poem, the images can give poems a kind of life like the life of the animals that I'm talking about. It can make a poem can actually start to feel as though it's almost breathing with the imagistic kind of wild sort of animal kind of presence that poems might have if you can get it in them.
Yes.
On this episode, and last week's, Paul Hetherington has spoken about the rigors of seeking out those nuances and casting them into words. Last week, Paul described one of his poems about a painting by Francis Bacon. He noted that as Bacon grapples with the slippery nuances of life, he projects a sense of crisis. Poetry on the Radio producer, Peter Monahan, referred to Bacon to ask Paul whether he has found, himself, that poetry can be a dangerous occupation.
You spoke about that primary impulse that you had, even as a child, to try and sort of puzzle out the interstices and the ineffable and so forth. But then you also talked about Bacon. I mean, in the most striking, I guess, consistent element of his images is that the flesh is falling apart, the boundaries aren't secure. And so I guess the personal question I would ask you is, you seem to have thrived in asking that question and exploring that ineffable, but there's a sort of a risk in it. It's the Bacon-like risk of crisis, constant crisis.
Yes, I'm fascinated by all that stuff that you're just talking about. And is there a personal risk? Well, I think if anyone who gives their life to art, to making, and some, I mean, it depends on the person to some extent, because some people are like really balanced, really sane people. I'm just trying to think whether I know any of them, but anyway. But I think if you go into the difficulty of making art and really caring about it, and caring about the art, not all the sort of trappings around it, not all the sort of talk and the social stuff, and all the even the prizes or all that stuff, if you really give yourself to the making of it, then, yeah, it presents challenges. It demands of you a hell of a lot of time and energy. It sometimes presents massive difficulties. I've had, you know, I live with a kind of a sense of failure as well as occasional sense of success. Although failure for me isn't, when I think of failure in terms of artistic or poetic terms, I don't think of it in the way that I think a lot of people think of failure. I just think of the fact that language is so vast and wonderful and extraordinary that all you can ever do is, I was using that Samuel Beckett idea, all you can ever do is really fail better. You can never quite perhaps make all the art you'd like to make. We certainly can't do that, if you me, and perhaps a lot of it isn't quite as good as you'd really like to make it. But on the other hand, I think good art recognises its own sense of failure in its making. Mm-hmm. And going back to Bacon, you know, that sense of dissolution, of collapse, of crisis, of constraint, of claustrophobia, of failure, of failure recognition of, you know, what we think of as individual sort of self in that crisis and collapse. I think that actually is truer to the experience of the world than a lot of the more conventional things that we tend to accept. And we accept a lot of that as conventional things because it's like, you know, when the traffic light goes green, we can go. And long as everybody agrees on that principle, that makes the world easier to navigate. We can accept that, you know, Paul Hetherington or Kimberly Williams is, you know, a vaguely, you know, rational human beings who, if we have a cup of coffee with them, won't upset us too much most of the time, kind of thing. But the wilder, crazier things that are going on amongst all of us are still there. They're mm-hmm. just not being recognised by all of those interactions. And I think it's not too bad a challenge to face the more difficult realities, providing you don't face them all at once. Poem by poem is my preference.
So in that sense, it's not an exercise in sort of wallowing in the things falling apart. It is that blessed rage for order. It's not monastic, but it's blessed in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is a kind of ongoing negotiation with crisis, with difficulty, with entropy. You know, I mean, we live in a world where things, you know, going back to the Yeats quotation, things are falling apart in a literal sense. The universe is expanding. We know that chaos is sort of with us, almost as a principle. And poetry and making, I think, both works with that and works to, yeah, bring some kind of sense of order or shaping or ways of understanding or connecting or negotiating humanly with those sorts of quite difficult and conceptually challenging realities, definitely.
Here's Paul Hetherington reading another of his poems, Pompeii. This recording is one he made for Poetry on the Radio segment in Art Sound's Thursday Arts Cafe program, where poets read a poem, comment on it, then read it again.
Pompeii. Pompeii is forgetfulness. Shrines with no ceremonies to garland them. Piazzas without throngs. Ovens without bread. Brothels are frankly frescoed, but years of anticipatory waiting have dissolved into earth. Painters inhabit fragile works rubbed by backpacks of tourists, and makers of mosaics have long since given up a braided delicacies of their hands. So many patterns to left and right of straight-lined streets, so much candour in buildings without roofs, air tunnels through bedroom, atrium, hortus alike, alien words rebound from buildings. What's left are intricate structures of mind. Follow them and find yourself lost on rutted stone. Hear shouts of the future, heavy as raining pumice, overlaying your life. That poem is a prose poem, Pompeii, from a book, Gallery of Antique Art, published recently by Recent Work Press. And the book as a whole considers the human response to art and to various other valuable places of culture and of heritage, such as Pompeii. And in considering the relationship between what we encounter in galleries or what we encounter in ruined places like Pompeii, it is trying to explore that weird connection where we can often feel very close to those places or those artworks, but simultaneously very distant from them. It's often a tantalizing experience, something which leaves us, I think, with a kind of a frisson of evanescence, a sense that we ourselves may one day be like what we're looking at. Pompeii. Pompeii is forgetfulness. Shrines with no ceremonies to garland them. Piazzas without throngs, ovens without bread. Brothels are frankly frescoed, but years of anticipatory waiting have dissolved into earth. Painters inhabit fragile works, rubbed by backpacks of tourists, and makers of mosaics have long since given up abraded delicacies of their hands. So many patterns to left and right of straight-line streets, so much candor in buildings without roofs, air tunnels through bedroom, atrium, hortus alike, alien words rebound from buildings. What's left are intricate structures of mind. Follow them and find yourself lost on rutted stone. Hear shouts of the future, heavy as raining pumice, overlaying your life.
And finally, here's a poem Paul Hetherington read recently at one of the Manning Clark House readings held on the fourth Thursday of each month. He and several other poets were asked to read a signature poem. Paul chose Rooms, a three-part prose poem.
I'm just going to read a short, relatively short, three-part prose poem called Rooms, partly because in the last half a dozen years or so I've been working on a lot of prose poems, and a lot of them have been around ideas of rooms and spaces, and this is one of the earlier of those. Rooms. One. When you are in the desert and undulations of dunes slide toward you, you may remember a room. Under shiny stars, in the cold sweep of night, you'll hold that room close. And in blade-like morning, when light strikes the ground like scattered gemstones, you may stare at distance and know that room as if it were in your body, a place in which you're strong, no matter how small its dimensions. It is like a skin that knows the flow of your blood. It's where you discover the value of limitation. Two, sometimes it contains a staircase. At other times, it's small and spare, smelling of plum cake and tart kumquat liqueur spilled on linoleum. Occasionally, it has ornate furniture and colourful half-pulled drapes. A boy hides behind a chest. A girl rubs a dresser's green satin between fingers. A dog pants, a bath runs nearby. The girl stands on tiptoe, looking through a cobweb window. Later, the boy sucks the inside of her thigh and she holds onto his hair. Sometimes the room is elongated high in a building. There are dark floorboards. Light squeezes through shutters. Three. Rooms are informed by what's no longer there. Light that wonders at you lying in a cot, space circling, dark drowning, walls like an unfixed firmament of mind. You grow up and forget those rooms, but they cling, become stairs without end, an intimate boudoir of dreaming, a lit mystery behind doors. Always old-fashioned, as if belonging to a different century. They are like early touch, haunting every exploration.
Paul Hetherington, reading at the Manning Clark House in September 2022. Thanks to Paul for sharing his thoughts and poems with us these past 2 weeks on Poetry on the Radio. Next week, we'll speak with another cherished Canberra poet, Kathy Kittaway, about her many years in poetry. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, July 3, Jeff's Poetry at Smith's Alternative presents Peter Bukowski and Hazel Hall. The work of much-travelled Melbourne-based poet Peter Bukowski has been translated into several languages. Canberra-based Hazel Hall's recent collections are Step by Step, Tai Chi Haiku from Picaro Poets, Severed Web from Picaro Poets, a verse drama, Please Add Your Signature and Date It Here from Latoria Press, and in 2023, Breathe In, Breathe Out from Picaro Poets. The Poetic City Winter Edition began on Saturday, July 1, and continues until Monday, July 10, when its closing night will take place at Smith's Alternative. On July 4, the festival presents A Flock of Words, poetry and art inspired by Sidney Nolan's Birds, with Acca Ballinger Constantine. There's also a drop-in poetry program for kids at Canberra Museum and Gallery from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. On Wednesday, July 5, the festival continues with Impromptu Poetry. The Majura Cafe poets host an As You Like It Cafe from 2 to 4 p.m. On July 6, Poetic City Winter Edition presents Fridge Magnet Poetry Olympics at the Poetry's Cool Street Library on the Northbourne Avenue median strip near Elinga Street between the Sydney and Melbourne buildings. You can take part there in Poetry Magnet Challenges. The event will include challenges for kids, teens and adults. On July 7, the Poetic City Winter Edition presents Slam Shop, a slam poetry workshop with Canberra Slam for young people aged 13 to 18. That's at the Street Theatre from 1 to 5 p.m. On Monday, July 10, the Poetry is Innovation Machine Symposium takes place from 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Cultural Centre Canberra on the ANU campus. Poetry as Innovation Machine is a curated symposium with speakers as wide-ranging as a mathematician to glass and textile artists who offer multidisciplinary approaches to poetry. Presentations will be short, 10 to 12 minutes, and might be anything from a performance to a delivered paper. The symposium is a collaboration between the University of Canberra Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Poetic City Canberra Winter 2023 edition, and Uncharted Territory Winter Innovation Festival. For all the events, search online for Poetic City Canberra Winter 2023 edition. The submission deadline for entries to the University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize has been extended from 30 June to 17 July. The University's Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, which administers the prize, has announced that the judges this year will be two internationally renowned poets, Tony Barnstone from the United States and Mani Rao from India. The 2023 winners will be announced by November 2023. The winner will receive $15,000, the runner-up $5,000, and there's also an international entrant award of $5,000. Search online for University of Canberra Vice-Chancellor's International Poetry Prize 2023. That deadline again is now 17 July. Among the 12 recipients of the 2023 First Nations Fellowships awarded this year by the Varuna Writers' Centre is Canberra-based Barkindji artist, critic and writer Barina South. She's been awarded a one-week residency to work on her manuscript of poetry at Varuna, which is in Katoomba in the Blue Mountains. The ACT Notable Book Awards, made each year by Marion, the ACT Writers' Centre, have been announced. The winner of the Poetry Prize in the awards is Penelope Leyland, the subject of two recent episodes of Poetry on the Radio. She won for her evocation in Beloved, recent work press, of Dorothy Wordsworth, sister of the renowned 19th century poet William Wordsworth. Named to the shortlist for the award were Peter Ram for Waterlines from Vagabond Press, Maurice Neville for Translating Loss, a haiku collection, and Kimberly K. Williams for Still Lives, Life Before Man from Gazebo Press. Kimberly is, of course, co-host of the program you're listening to, Poetry on the Radio. Poetry on the Radio is produced on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Art Sound FM in Canberra. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produce the program with me, Peter Monahan. The music on today's program is Lengua from Gnosis by Cuban pianist David Varelas. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by the Atrium Musica de Madrid.